Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Look, we're coming into the election cycle right now. We all should be very, very motivated and very excited because we all know this is the seminal election. We know Obama's not running, but he is running. This is a mandate about the communist in the White House. I mean, I speak quite bluntly. I speak quite openly. I don't mince words. Obama is our first Marxist president. I don't need anyone to spell it out for me. I don't need the schmucks at AP to tell me I'm right or wrong. Okay? I'll tell you what's right or wrong. I will tell you what I see. I will tell you that any educated European knows that Obama is the first Marxist president. Okay? We know this. So America's going to the polls in November to say yes to socialism or no to socialism. Anyone affiliated with Obama, we all know, will clearly, well, let's put it another way. Let me rephrase the question. Anyone who he is campaigning for, who does not get reelected, will not get reelected because he's too closely tied to the president. Let's put it to you that way. So again, I ask you, why do you suppose there's going to be a tidal wave that's coming? It's not so much because there's going to be new voters at all. It's because the silenced majority, who I have defined for 16 years, Agnew called you the silent majority, but under the socialist communist media that we have, the government media complex, you have become silenced. The silenced majority has not voted in a long time. The silenced majority listen to the Savage Nation and other conservative talk shows. The silenced majority have created small groups, grassroots groups called Tea Party groups. And the silenced majority is going to come out across the land. It's freaking out the members of the self-appointed arista at the New York Times and elsewhere. They're part of the old guard. They're frightened to death of you. They call you names. They really, you know, the reason they call you Nazis and whatnot is because they actually think you are. But you have to understand that they're mentally ill. The reason people like Maureen Dowd would call Sarah Palin and Engel and the others names is because she's afraid of them. She calls them the mean girls from high school, the kind of girls who spray painted your locker, et cetera, because she's afraid of them. Because people like Maureen Dowd and the other old-timers from the New York Times are frightened of real American women. They never meet them. They never run into them. They don't know what they look like. Most of these women are not mothers, the leftists now. They never got married, or if they did, they didn't have children, or their husbands left them for another man. So they don't like women who are real women with children and grandmothers. They hate them, as a matter of fact. To them, an American grandmother is a fascist. To them, an American grandfather is a neo-Nazi. That's to show you how mentally deranged they really are. And so they're going to throw the bums out. Now, that doesn't mean all will be well. I've warned you that many of the Republicans are snakes in sharkskin suits, if they still sell sharkskin. It's just a nice turn of phrase. Many of them are the same old Bushites, the K Street mob, and they would be another disaster waiting to happen. The only hope that I see on the horizon would be the Tea Party candidates who are business people and conservative. Because we are in the last days of America. If we don't throw them out in 2 weeks, then Obama says, aha, although it was close, we only lost 15 seats. And that's the word I want to use is collateral damage. In other words, we'll keep pushing our socialist agenda. And it doesn't matter because we'll only lose another 15 seats next time. And it's worth it for us to see our communist dreams realized. Do you understand that? So to them, losing seats, if it's too small, would be collateral damage. It would be worth what they did to this country. In other words, well, turn it around. It would be worth their losing the 15 seats for what they could get away with in terms of ripping off the country and ripping off our democracy. You don't seem to understand how they think I do. You're very fortunate that you have a man like Michael Savage in America able to understand the enemy and explain them to you. Listen to me. I had a satori, an understanding, a deep one, and here it is. It's about deep conservatism versus small conservatism. Big C, little C. You see, back in the 60s, just when the environmental movement was getting underway, there was a movement to clean up trash along the highways, clean up the streets and the roads, to pick up the dirt. Now, the people who cleaned up the trash on the sides of the highway were well-meaning, and they called themselves ecologists. And later on, there emerged a much more serious movement of environmentalists, and for good or for bad. And they wanted to go beyond just fixing superficial environmental problems. They wanted to try and rid the toxins from foods and waters. And many of them did a very good job up to a point. Sure, they overdid it in some areas, as we all know. But they understood it was more than just garbage on the side of a highway that had to be cleaned up in order to save mankind and save the planet. And these environmentalists called themselves deep ecologists, and they were doing what was known as deep ecology. Today we have the same thing in politics. Little C conservatives. What they are doing is cleaning up the trash left on the sides of the road, by the liberals. But then there are deep conservatives with a big C. Deep conservatives who are going after the systemic problems, the root of the problems, the source of the toxins caused by the liberals and liberalism. And remember, there's a big difference between a little C and a big C. Little conservatives and deep conservatives, as I have spelled out on this show on a regular basis for 16 years. And it all comes to a head in my new book, Trickle Up Poverty, where the true deep conservatism that I am talking about is spelled out for future generations. The Savage Army is being called upon. I am asking you to act to stop the Democrats before it is too late.
Savage.
From chapter 1 of PUP. Here it is. Many years ago, while I was in graduate school in Hawaii, a near-death boating experience on the high seas taught me a life lesson that directly relates to the problems we're having with President Obama. Do you know what it's like for a kid from New York City to wind up in Hawaii? I'd never been to a place as remarkable as Hawaii. It was like walking into heaven itself. When you land in heaven, you think you can do anything. Almost overnight, you have hubris. Hubris is a sense of excessive self-confidence that only children and the mad should have. But when a grown-up has hubris, it becomes very dangerous. And in my case, that was true. So I get to the islands, and it's a magical time. I never saw sunsets like this. They can break your heart. And the flowers, the plumeria blossoms, are beyond description. I used to bicycle up to the University of Hawaii, and I would see plumeria blossoms lying on the sidewalk. I'd stop the bicycle and pick up the plumeria blossoms for a closer look, and of course to smell them. I'd never seen anything like them. Sure, we had rose petals on the fence back in the Bronx when I was a kid. They were soft and beautiful in their own way, but this was something unique. The perfumed scent of the plumeria was unlike anything on the mainland. There I am, surrounded by such incredible beauty. The yellow hibiscus, the golden sunsets, the colorful rainforest birds in the back of the valley that I'd never known existed. And before long, I start to get turned into my own body in a way I'd never tuned into my own body in a way I'd never been tuned into. Here's how the Hawaiian transformation works. Even if you've never lived in the tropics, you instinctively start shedding clothing. It's off with the long sleeves, the shoes, and leather. You put it all away, and now you're in flip-flops and shorts. At night, the breeze zips through your sleeves, and you start to become alive in a new way. You're drawn to the ocean. With the migratory seagulls soaring overhead, you start to feel like the original man. In that magical state of mind, you decide to buy a sailboat. I bought the Taranga. Actually, it was the Tarangi, a sloop-rigged sailing vessel about 22 feet long, made primarily of white oak. It had been built in Oregon and sailed out by somebody to Hawaii. I bought it for next to nothing. Although she was in perfect shape, she had no engine. I kept her in the Aliwai Marina and quickly learned most people who own boats mainly use them to drink on and just hang out. Me? I was foolish enough to actually want to sail the boat, even though I knew nothing about sailing. What's more, I decided to take her out without an engine. I figured it would be easy to get out because the wind was prevailing westward out of the harbor. A few of my new friends released the lines, cast me off, and pushed me backward for my maiden voyage. So there I was sailing down the Aliwai Channel and then out into the ocean by myself. I zipped along with the sail wide open, heading further out to sea. I was thinking, this is unreal. I can do anything. It wasn't long before I realized I had miscalculated the situation. Simply put, I didn't know how to get back. Suddenly my mind was racing for answers. You know, how do I turn this thing around if the wind is blowing out to sea? I had no idea, not a clue. The sloop didn't come with an owner's manual. I hadn't paid for lessons. So I'm thinking I had better figure out what to do because at the rate I was going, I'd soon be in the middle of the Pacific Ocean with no way back at all. What's worse, I had no radio, no flares, no engine, and no provisions. I don't think I even had a life preserver. I know that sounds crazy, but remember, I was an inexperienced operator. I didn't know what I didn't know. Besides, the late 60s was an age when many people had total madness about what they could do and accomplish, whether or not it had a basis in reality. I admit all I had was hubris. My first move, I resorted to common sense. I dropped the sails because that, of course, would cut the motion of the boat. With the sails secured, I tried using the tiller to turn the boat around. You know, flip-flop, flip-flop, until I got the boat pointing back toward land. Then I figured if the wind is blowing against me, there must be a way to go into a prevailing wind and still move against it. I had seen other people do it, and little by little, lo and behold, I was able to return to the harbor. I still don't know whether it was pure luck, a strong undercurrent, or God's hand pushing me to safety. I quickly learned that sailing is not for the amateur. Here's the connection to President Obama. America is the boat. Whoever is at the helm determines her destination. If he's experienced, if he's wise, if he understands the fundamentals of boating, then all is well. She'll remain safe and strong, able to sail again for generations to come. If not, apart from a lucky break or God's direct intervention, she'll drift further out into dangerous waters without a prayer of survival. It all comes down to the heart, soul, and experience of the sailor. Does the sailor have a healthy respect for the laws of boating on the high seas, or does he ignore them and do as he pleases, putting himself and the boat in mortal peril? Is he wise enough to recognize the danger signs on the horizon and quickly change course? Or in the face of certain disaster, is he too arrogant and reckless to make the necessary adjustments while there's still time? We're living in dangerous times. Page 3. We have a political novice in America's wheelhouse. Moreover, the president is propelled only by a dangerous hyperdosage of hubris. Is that an overstatement? We all know the former junior senator from Illinois had about a 5-minute political career before campaigning for the highest office in the land. In other words, Obama has no governing experience. He doesn't know how to lead. Worse, he has been indoctrinated by Marxist professors. He's convinced that the failed ideas of Marxism and socialism will suddenly work now that he's in charge of the ship. However, the navigational chart he's relying on to steer the country from capitalism to socialism is fatally flawed. And now he's lost and over his head. Obama has taken a hammer and sickle to our economy, saddling us with a national debt we can never repay. He's exercising ultra-tolerance with Islamic terrorists, rendering America vulnerable. What's more, there's not a scintilla of bipartisan consensus in Congress, as Obama had promised. It's gridlock while the middle class is shell-shocked. Let me put it to you this way. Obama never ran a state before he became the head of state. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. There's so much more I can do, but I can't do it all in one day. Let's go to callers. That's the important thing. New York, Robert, you're on the Savage Nation.
Yes, Michael, a couple of weeks ago you were talking about a impressionistic show that you saw, you know, particularly of Van Gogh, and how wonderful it was. You have to remember that when they painted, they weren't readily accepted. It took 50 years. Them to be accepted.
Yes.
And that may be true with you. You know, here you have 8 million now listening to you out of 320 or whatever is in this country. As you continue on, more and more will catch up to you.
Yeah, but I don't think I can do radio for another 50 years. That's the problem.
We're in a different time warp.
That's right, true. And things are accelerated. You're right. Electronically, 50 years today could be 5 years.
Right. Exposure in the 1880s to, 2010, it's totally different. And I would think that maybe the idea of you running for the Senate.
Well, there's an old saying that in medicine, the way when I was early on in the health, the medical health field, meaning I was into alternative medicine before it became fashionable, I was writing books on nutrition and herbal medicine, homeopathy, and people considered it crazy and insane. I don't know of one listener to this show who probably doesn't take a vitamin on a regular basis, probably very few, particularly men over 40. So, we've come a long way, baby. But the way it worked was this in medicine. Any new invention or any new finding in medicine was usually at first ignored by the medical establishment. After it was ignored, it was ridiculed. After it was ridiculed, it was attacked. And then finally it was accepted. So there are stages to acceptance for new ideas or new delivery systems. I have been in this business for 16 years. I pioneered the concept of the independent conservative. Remember that. Rush has always been a water carrier for the Republican Party. He even admitted it at one point, but then he backed off from that. And so therefore, I accept to be ignored. I mean, I expect to be ignored. Just like any other innovator, at first you're ignored, then you're attacked or ridiculed, and then eventually you're accepted. So it's no question, there's no question that in time, many, many more millions of people will get the message that is in trickle-up poverty, because it goes well beyond the radio show. It sort of memorializes everything this man has done to us and wants to do to us. This has been like a shot in the arm for me. It's been a long time in coming. I've been laboring under this, writing this book, sweating the book, dreading Hell Week. The Tuesday morning wake-up and going down to that TV studio was the toughest thing I've done in my adult life in a very long time. I don't like television. I feared it. I was trepidatious. I didn't want to do it. And I did it because I committed to it to the publisher. And guess what? It went off without a hitch. And so here we are.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Let me do this for my own sake. I started reading about the puppet masters in my chapter, Nightmare on Wall Street. And the most important part of that chapter should not be forgotten. And that is that $10 trillion of America's assets disappeared in 2008. And what I wrote was there was an agenda lurking behind the shadowy dealings. Is it a coincidence that this happened right before the presidential election? And I say hardly. Where did those dollars go? They didn't disappear. How many times have I told you that the dollars didn't disappear? They ended up in the hands of a relatively small number of people and companies whose purpose was far more nefarious than merely making profits. The raiders who trashed our markets sought nothing less than to use the control they had gained over our financial system to put a wet-behind-the-ears leftist president in office. Moreover, they leveraged that power to create a government run on socialist principles, but controlled by a small group of wealthy investors who dictate policy to the puppet president they elected. In effect, they pushed us further along the path to a socialist oligarchy. That's a paragraph from Trickle Up Poverty. I am telling you, it's true. I verify it with facts. And I name some of the puppet masters. In my opinion, the Managed Funds Association, a group of hedge funds investors with whom Soros is affiliated, lobbied SEC Chairman Christopher Cox to have the rules changed. Now, remember, Christopher Cox was a Republican. And why did they do it? They did this to engineer a raid on U.S. markets to trigger a financial crisis that they foresaw could turn the election in favor of their 08 candidate, Barack Obama. This time, the strategy worked. So they allegedly manipulated the marketplace. And I say those who manipulated the marketplace are free. And some of them did so, and they're now denying they did so. But I said there were hundreds and hundreds of minor players involved in this fraud as well. So, ladies and gentlemen, there are very powerful interests behind this. And, of course, they're going to disparage me. I know for a fact that right now they're buying bloggers to go online and put down Michael Savage and put down the book. They are threatened by this coming out. It's not just rhetoric that I have. There are facts in it. Many of you don't want to read the book. So let me go on. Let me talk about the uptick rule that was eliminated under the last administration, and the uptick rule that was eliminated by Obama, and who did it and why they did it. During Christopher Cox's term at the SEC, the uptick rule in the stock market was eliminated on July 6, 2007. The rule initially adopted in 1938, this is so important for you to hear, 1938 was one of the primary reasons we were able to recover from the Great Depression. This uptick rule limited short sales to stocks whose last trade was higher than the previous one. The uptick rule meant that traders who sell short could not cause the market price of a stock to drop continuously at a precipitous rate. Once the rule was removed, and it was removed in 07, naked short selling was enabled, and the circumstances were ripe for a raid, such as the one that occurred in 2008. This is in the chapter called The Puppet Masters, or Nightmare on Wall Street. Let me read you another paragraph. I know it's hard for many people to listen to this. Mark-to-market accounting standards were implemented on November 15, 2007. And look, I'm not going to read it to you because when you read it, it's hard for people to follow it. I know radio as well as anybody who's ever done radio, and I can tell when you don't want to follow it anymore. All you got to know is I have the facts in here, and that's why they're trashing the book. They don't want you to understand what went on. They don't want you to see this, and they don't want you to judge for yourself. If it was just a book, hawking a book and putting down the president, I really wouldn't be going on and on about it. Everything is at stake, okay? You think that that market crash occurred by accident? You're mistaken. The situation is exacerbated by Mary Shapiro, who replaced Christopher Cox when he resigned from the chairmanship of the SEC in 2009. Shapiro, along with Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, has long been a supporter of mark-to-market accounting practices. Investors in the stock market fear the potential for the same risks that severely damaged the market in 08 and are reluctant to get back into the market as fully as they might. Banks are reluctant to assume the risk of lending to businesses, especially small businesses, because of the risk that Shapiro will reinstitute some form of mark-to-market rules for banks and other financial firms, again causing them to mark down their assets and precipitating another liquidity crisis like that of 08. The result was what appeared to be an economic stalemate until early May of 2010. Are you listening to this? Here it comes. On the afternoon of May 6th, the Dow Jones Industrial Average plummeted 998.5 points in a matter of minutes, the largest intraday drop in the history of the Dow. As usual, commentators and analysts missed the mark completely when trying to unravel what had happened. Some speculated that a trader had mistakenly added too many zeros to the number of shares he was selling and triggered the fall. Others blamed the Greek debt crisis and the underlying weakness in the euro and the EU's approach to the financial woes. Still others blamed the rise in electronic trading for causing the drop. While there was certainly some validity in the last two, in fact, the immediate trigger of the sudden sell-off in May of 2010 was very likely a raid by short sellers on the stock market. Are you listening to me? Disclosed in trickle-up poverty. Now you know why it's being disparaged all over the web by those who don't want you to get the truth. First of all, the precipitous drop occurred shortly after 2:30 in the afternoon. That should have been a clue to those trying to figure out what had happened. As Nelson D. Schwartz and Louise Story explain, well, I can't read everything in this book. Do you understand I'm excited right now? I go to this point. That in itself points the finger directly at short sellers. In fact, the May 6th drop was quite possibly the work of hedge fund traders raiding the market with the intent to send the message that they could still do whatever they wanted, despite the fact that only days earlier, a new, quote, alternative uptick rule had been put in place. They demonstrated clearly that the new rule had no teeth whatsoever, that traders who staged the raid were free to do what they would do for the remainder of the afternoon. Do you understand what I'm saying to you? It's the hedge fund traders who are controlling the economy right now, and they've got the politicians on strings. And I say to you this, this is as un-American on the face of it. This is un-American on the face of it. What has occurred over the past several years is a power grab of epic proportions, and no one in Congress is even close to understanding what happened and what a dangerous position we're in. From a high of more than 14,000 October 07, the Dow Jones average had lost nearly half of its value by the time of the 08 election. Much of the lost money went into the pockets of the hedge fund raiders, who, thanks to changes permitted by the SEC, were able to sell short with no limits, further driving down asset values. SEC's giving in to those lobbying on behalf of the MFA costs millions of average Americans invested in the stock market and in money market funds through their 401k plans as much as half the value of the assets they had planned to retire on. The raid made Bernie Madoff look like a piker. By the way, SEC also looked the other way where Madoff was concerned. Page 87. By the time John McCain correctly called for Cox's resignation as part of his bumbling response to the financial meltdown that cost him the election, it was already too late. In his response to McCain, Cox disingenuously said, quote, "We have no tolerance for naked short selling, close quote. Despite the fact that under his leadership, that's precisely what the SEC enabled, reference number 8. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you think this is just hype, if you think it's just a book with empty pages in it, if you think it's just another puff book with a talk show looking to sell a book and get rich quick, I welcome you to read this book and refute it. You want to go and listen to the junkie on HBO who smokes dope every night on Sunset Boulevard in one cheap Listen, there's so much I could say right now. You want to listen to these facile lunatics on television who think they're so smart because they read words written for them by comedy writers? Go ahead. Listen to them if you want. Or if you want to read the facts and you want to challenge these shysters, go ahead. It's all in my book.
Savage.
Welcome back to the show. I mean, there's a lot of disclosing and disturbing material in here about the treachery behind this story. And I was talking about the shadowy world government called the Bilderberg Group. Go ahead, laugh. Take another stoking. Smoke another joint. Keep laughing, you schmucks in Hollywood and New York who think you're so damn smart. Just remember, while you were in a comedy club, stoned out of your mind, trying to make it as a comedian, I was plodding along. I earned my PhD and I was saving rainforests. So don't lecture me. That's what I'd say right to your face, which is why you won't have me on your show, because I'd rip you apart like the cockroach that you are. And I think you know who I'm talking to here on this show, these phonies out there, these wise guys who have nothing to say unless someone writes it for them. So let me go on, if you don't mind. The Bilderberg Group is a secretive organization whose activities from its inception in 1954 remain hidden from both press and public scrutiny. While little is known about their inner workings, we do know that the Bilderberg Group is an international consortium of politically and economically powerful people who envision a new world order, with them at the top pulling the strings. They are dyed-in-the-wool pan-Leninists. Now, let me pause here. I don't care whose book you have read this last week or two. Have you seen the phrase pan-Leninist anywhere? No, you haven't. You've seen the same old Marxist, socialist, because they learned that from me 2 years ago. The blackboard people. They heard me say Marxist 2 years ago already. There were 5 books already on Marxism, socialism. Well, let them be a little clearer about what they are. These people are pan-Leninists. They're egotists of the lowest order who want to effectively erase national boundaries and control the world economy. And, by the way, here's the shocking point. They have the connections to pull it off. After all, the Bilderberg Group isn't a bunch of average blue-collar guys working the night shift at a bowling alley. Far from it. The membership list from past attendees reads like a who's who of United States and international politics, finance, and communications. And here it comes. You're not going to want to hear it. Page 88, including former U.S. President Bill Clinton, Fox News owner and media mogul Rupert Murdoch. By the way, he came out last week in favor of illegal immigration. Remember that? And then all of a sudden, all of the puppets were in favor, all of a sudden, overnight, of illegal immigration. Well, the leprechaun's long been in favor of illegal immigrants and granting amnesty. You know that. How he gets away with it, I'll never understand. On the same list as Rupert Murdoch and Bill Clinton is George Soros, Timothy Geithner, Richard Holbrooke, EU Bank President Jean-Claude Trichet, Fed Chairman Bernd Bernanke, and U.S. Senators Chris Dodd, Dianne Feinstein, amongst others. You hear what I'm telling you? Those attending from the U.S. You want me to do this or not? Because I'm going to do it. I have names. There's a whole page of them. Those attending the Bilderberg from the U.S. in 2010 included Roger Altman, chairman, Evercore Partners, Sonia Arison, author and policy analyst, Timothy C. Collins, senior managing director and CEO of Ripplewood Holdings. You never heard of these people, right? Martin Feldstein, George Baker Professor of Economics, Harvard University. Neil Ferguson, Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of History at Harvard. William Gates, co-chair, Bill and Linda Gates Foundation, and chairman, Microsoft Corporation. Philip H. Gordon, Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs. Donald Graham, chairman and CEO, The Washington Post. I mean, they're all here. I don't have the time. I don't think you want to listen to this. But these people are the people who are the shadow government of the New World Order. They're here. They're there. Page 89, that's just a list of those who are coming from the U.S. that we know of. Many who attend choose to be anonymous, and as such are not included in this list. We also know that the annual meeting of these elitists is a heavily guarded affair, complete with armed sentinels. Why the secrecy? What are these heads of states, financial tycoons, and world leaders saying and doing behind closed doors? Let's be clear. I'm not a conspiracy thrill seeker. The fact of the matter is that where there's smoke, there's fire. Once in a while, a picture of their aspirations for world control emerges. Take, for example, this statement made by Bilderberg member David Rockefeller. In his 2002 book entitled Memoirs, Rockefeller wrote this: "Some even believe we are part of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States, characterizing my family and me as, quote, internationalists, and of conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global political and economic structure. One world, if you will. If that's the charge, I stand guilty, and I am proud of it." Reference number nine. Reference number nine. Well, you want to read more about it? Go to Michael Savage's book, Trickle Up Poverty. Another pundit claims the Bilderberg Group's overall objective is the elimination of the middle class and the creation of a world order comprised only of rulers and servants, and using such tactics as the establishment of such instruments as green taxes, including cap and trade legislation, in order to control the world energy market and to subjugate the world citizens in the interest of combating the now proven fraudulent notion of man-made global warming. Do you understand what I'm saying to you? This is way beyond the comedian who's known to frequent nightclubs on Sunset Boulevard and has a show on HBO who accuses anyone who opposes this group and Obama as being a racist. It's way beyond the potheads on HBO. It's way beyond the comedians from comedy clubs around America who have been made very successful by power brokers who control the media. You understand what I'm saying to you? Now, what does all this have to do with the financial crisis that sent Wall Street reeling out of control, says Michael? Plenty. It validates the idea that the run on the American economy was ultimately a conspiracy designed to elect a leftist, globalist president of the United States. How else do you explain the actions of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton in June of 2008 during the campaign when they ditched members of the press and disappeared? According to one report, during their absence, the two candidates were meeting secretly with members of the Bilderberg Group in a Northern Virginia hotel to discuss Obama's and Clinton's involvement with the group after the election. It is also reported that powerful businessman James A. Johnson, a Bilder Group member, selected Obama's running mate after the Democratic primary, which is why investigating the abuses on Wall Street is the furthest thing from Barack Obama's mind. In my opinion, Mr. Obama would rather conspire with the members of the Bilderberg Group to control the world. And what better way could Obama endear himself to this inner circle of globalists than to keep Wall Street vulnerable to outside manipulation in the future? You'll have to read the rest yourself. I'm very excited to expose this in my book. It's way past the point that I could pull the book back. I understand what danger I'm in for having written the book. But you know what? The cat is out of the bag. They printed 145,000 copies. The entire first run has been, the first order has been sold out at Barnes & Noble even before people read this expose. Tell me what's going to happen when people in America, even people who are cynical and doubt me, who's he? Another right winger out there? Another talk show host? Well, I dare you to read the book and say that about me. Let's go to the callers for a moment. Let's go to New York City. Robert from WOR. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Michael. I don't know about bringing your book into a polling place, but I'll tell you where I bring my book. I bring it into my bedroom. My wife and I, every night before we go to bed, we lay down and read your book. And for all intents and purposes, lots of fun. After the book, nobody wants to go to sleep. Let's just put it this way.
Well, you're probably a little agitated when you read the book because you realize what he's actually done and what he intends to do.
That's exactly right. You know, it gets the blood pumping.
Robert, I speak to middle-class people, not regularly, but sometimes, hardworking business people, let's put it that way. And I say to them, do you really believe that if this man had the power, he would seize your property? He said to me, 100%, that's what I believe. I believe 100%, every one of them says to me that if this administration had the power to do so, they would seize private property in this country and take away people's houses. That is the fear that we have of this man. Now, why is it that everyone fears him like this? Any property owner fears this man. Why does he project such fear? The answer is because he has been a pan-Leninist since he's a child. That's why. He is a naked revolutionary. That's why. He's just a very good actor, Robert.
For all intents and purposes, he has never ran a business. He has never ran a lemonade stand. And for him to sit up there and tell us how to run our business, how to put bread on our table, insulting. That's
Robert, I'm sending you another copy. I hope it doesn't ruin your marriage, because right now you're in the marital bed, both sharing the book. But what happens if I send you another copy? Will it drive you and your wife apart?
Well, no, that one's going directly to my dad, because actually, I spoke to you last week. You sent me a copy last week. I couldn't wait for the copy to come. I went to a local Borders, and I got another copy. That's the copy I'm
All right, you're being honest. I'm still sending it to you for your father.
So much.
And by the way, if you want him to read it in the bed with you, that's fine, too. I don't care. All right, stay on the line. You know already what's going on. What's the one going to bash Obama? You know who he is already. Everything he says, they laugh at him. Oh, there he is again.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Battle between Paladino and Cuomo, where they say Paladino said something that was quite homophobic. And I would say this to Mr. Paladino. Now, Cuomo was a lifetime far-left radical, as you know. His dad, a good man, I'm sure, was a super left-winger, anti-death penalty, pro-welfare state. In other words, all of the progressive policies that were suffering from under Obama were tried out by Andrew Cuomo's father. What was his father's name? Mario, correct? So Mr. Paladino is being called homophobic, and I'm going to give Mr. Paladino a one-liner that could win the election for him. He should get up there today, and he should say, I am not homophobic, I am Cuomophobic. Cymbal shot. Crash. Boom. I am not homophobic, I'm Cuomophobic. And that's the end of the election. He wins right away. Now, I gave a one-liner to, what's his name, the guy from Arizona whose name I forgot already. The guy crashed the airplane and blew it up on the deck. John McCain, that's right. I gave him the one line of trickle-up poverty during the campaign against Obama. His dumb handlers wouldn't even let him see the line because they didn't want him to win. But I told him, I said it right on this show. I said, if you give this to McCain and he goes out tonight and debates Obama in the final debate that time, I said he could just smile and do Reagan-esque and say, look, we've heard it all before, Mr. Obama. We know what's coming, Mr. Obama. It's been tried in Russia, Mr. Obama. It's been tried in Eastern Europe, Mr. Obama. It's called trickle-up poverty. That would have been the end of the election, and we'd have McCain. But the Republicans didn't want him to win. They knew that they had sacked the Treasury for eight straight years, and now it was time to hoodwink the people and let the Dems sack the Treasury for 8 years until eventually there's nothing left. We are like the proverbial sporting goods store taken over by the mafia. Both sides are basically running up the credit cards for the airline tickets and moving the inventory out of the back door, selling it off the back of trucks. That's fundamentally what America has become to the two parties. So don't tell me that the solution is more Republicanism. Now, the fact is we need conservatives, not Republicans. So I say, Paladino, all he's got to do is get up and say, I'm not homophobic, I'm homophobic. And that's the end of it. Also, I'd like to hear about bookstore horror stories on the Savage Nation. Like if they said, come with me down into the dungeon, I'll show you where we keep it. Or the girl with the nose ring and the pink hair and the green eyelids said, come with me into the ladies' room and I'll show you the book. Or if you have a bookstore horror story about TUP, let me know about it. We have wonderful, wonderful news out there. As I understand that the Purple Gang at Fox News is furious. I understand that the Westies are furious and out of their minds. The Westies are crazy that they were unable to keep me down and that you, the people, listen to this show. I told you what this proved. It proves that talk radio is still king in terms of influence over the people when it comes to ideas and the dissemination of ideas and selling books. How else would you explain that my book became number one overall? I beat all fiction, all nonfiction. How do you explain it? It's a fluke. I bought a million copies. I didn't buy them. You bought them one at a time. The people went out there and bought them. So it's a big story out there, by the way. Paladino ups ante, slams Cuomo over gay pride parade. As I say, Paladino, all he's got to do is say, I am not homophobic, I am Cuomophobic. That's the end of the election. And then when the Republicans take over, they take Soros and they try him for crimes against America. They drag Soros in an orange jumpsuit, and all of the arrogance that you saw with Madoff is gone. You know, Soros, in my opinion, is just Madoff prime. He's Madoff on steroids. He's a much smarter Madoff. He takes down whole governments instead of entire Jewish neighborhoods. That's all. So there it is. My position is this. You have proven that the Savage Nation is the Tea Party of radio. We have broken away. We have broken out. And let me tell you something else. Talk radio has come back with a roar. The media loudly proclaimed that the blogosphere was the new thing, that everyone would gravitate towards the internet, that radio was for the elderly, that there was no media for old men. Well, they were wrong. Every blogger who has come out with a book that I know of has failed miserably. Nobody knows who they are. They hide in their bedrooms, typing out hate on their computers and their bathrobes. I put myself on the line every day on this show. People know who I am. They know what I like and what I do. They even know who my dog Teddy is. And I believe for that reason, and because of those reasons, they have developed a personal relationship with me, Michael Savage. You've heard the reviewers on Amazon.com saying that like I'm an uncle to them. You've heard the caller say that they're willing to sleep in a parking lot outside a bookstore overnight in their truck to wait for it to open so they can buy trickle-up poverty. The people relate to me. They care, and they act, and they know that I'm the real thing. They know that I'm giving them the truth, not just putting on a show for ratings or money. This is more than a show. This is a phenomenon. The book is number one. You are part of something right now much bigger and much stronger and much more tangible than the internet will ever be. The empty suits and the empty skirts have long since predicted the death of talk radio, but it is not dying. Talk radio is getting stronger. I may be the first in the medium to say that, but I know it to be true. How else do you explain a book going to number one without a single review in the newspapers, without the support of Fox or CNN or MSNBC, without those snide jerks on MSNBC? No one listens to you. You're irrelevant. Nobody listens to you. How was it done without even Fox News, who won't have me on? How is it possible? I'm invisible to them. They thought that they had me in a box. They thought I was irrelevant. They thought that in order to be successful, you have to come through Mr. Leprechaun. Well, let me tell you something. I pushed Leprechaun down 4 or 5 slots. And let me tell you something else. I pushed Leprechaun down, and I don't need him. Leprechaun needs me. They have everything upside down. And you know why? Because I speak the truth, and they don't. It's not the media that spread the word about this book. It is you, the members of the Savage Nation. It's not the media that spread out across the nation and demanded the book from every local bookstore in America. It's you, the listener. It's not the media that pushed back every time a snotty left-wing clerk sneered that they wouldn't carry the book because I'm Michael Savage. It was you, the listener. And that's why not just Obama, but every traitorous false Republican in politics and the media should be frightened. They have lost their grip on the people themselves. Without their help, then they're going to the wrong people if they think they're going to get elected. Let me tell you something. If fake conservatives keep going to these wrong outlets and think they're going to get elected, they're wrong. I'm going to tell you right now, if I can push a comedian off the list, and if I can push Bob Woodward down, one man alone, no support, speaking the truth, because the truth is the ultimate victor.
Savage.
I want to talk about the bedbug infestation in New York City that is reaching virtually every avenue of society, from the poor to the rich, and whether you think this is a harbinger of the demise of our civilization, of our society. I mean, this is a previously eradicated pest problem. These bugs were beaten back for decades. But what happened is the Ivy League ruling class outlawed the organophosphates and the carbamate insecticides, and the replacement green products are not as effective as their predecessors. And as a result, if you look at when the bedbug epidemic started, you'll find that it was Al Gore and the EPA who frankly gave us the opportunity, or the opportunity for the bugs to proliferate now in New York City. It's a tyranny of the foolish. It's a tyranny of the idiots. And as C.S. Lewis wrote, of all tyrannies, a tyranny exercised for the good of its victims may be the most oppressive. It may be better to live under robber barons than under omnipotent moral busybodies. The robber baron's cruelty may sometimes sleep. His cupidity may at some point be satiated. But those who torment us for our own good will torment us without end, for they do so with the approval of their own conscience. And that's what we have now with these Ivy League morons who are ruining everything around them. I entered talk radio in 94 with the show called Immigrants and Epidemics. What's important for me to tell you is this. Many of the third world, of the issues of the third world that were gone in America, that had disappeared, are now presently emerging in the United States of America. The rampant, for example, the beheadings of police in Mexico. Do you think that's not going to come across the border with Janet Napolitano unwilling to crack down on this invasion? I think we're going to have the very same thing happening here, the same way the bedbugs have invaded America. Unless the borders are totally secured right now, we're going to have the same kind of corruption and the beheading of our own police. God forbid, but I'm telling you, it's coming across the border. Because unless we put the U.S. military there with tanks, we're going to have it in this country. Instead, we have Obama opening up our border even further than Bush opened the border. And so we go back to the simple issue of the bedbug problem. How is it that for decades there were no bedbugs to speak of in New York City or anywhere else in America? And where did this epidemic suddenly come from? Is it a result of massive, massive waves of immigration from the third world? Shall I say that to you again? Do you think there are no consequences to bringing in individuals who are not screened for health problems? Your grandfather, great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather had to go through Ellis Island, perhaps. If they were sick, they were turned away or they were put in quarantine until they got better. We don't even screen people. They can come in with the most fulminating tuberculosis and land in your hometown and go to your hospital and infect your doctor and nurse. And the government would arrest you if you dared say a word. That's a government upside down. That's why the people are up in arms. These nincompoop idiots who went to Ivy League schools don't know the first thing about anything. And consequently, the country is has had enough. The country is screaming, stop now, we're going to throw you out. Now, I know bed bugs were mentioned in ancient Greece. I know they go back a long time. And I know that prior to the mid-20th century, bed bugs were very common. I'm aware of all of that. But the bed bugs were wiped out until the organophosphates, that is DDT and such, were banned as a result of Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring. And so here we now face bed bugs in the highest places in New York City. And there's no chance of stopping them without using chemicals again, chemicals that were once banned. And I tell you this, you wait until the diseases start coming up in this country as they come across the border. You wait until you see the diseases that were once annihilated in this country or eliminated reappearing again. Diseases such as leprosy, tuberculosis, cholera. I know what I'm talking about. I'm not a TV host. I'm a trained epidemiologist. And I'm telling you, it's only a matter of time until you see this happening again. This emerging third world picture of the United States of America is a direct result of the open borders. And as I say, I've been after this issue since 94. I own this issue. Bush was no better. Bush opened up the highways to Mexico. Don't you remember the big fight over those superhighways with no inspections? What was that all about? Why do both parties want an open border with Mexico? I'll let you figure it out. I'll let you figure it out. So if you think a big R and a little R next to the name is going to save you, you're wrong. To me, the borders are key. You say the economy is number one, and I agree with you, but the borders and the immigration problem are directly tied to the economy. And Obama's war on our border, which is an interesting use of phrase, it's all about the vote, it's all about the cheap labor. We all know that, we heard that. But let's look at the immigration problem from the point of view of health. What is the real cost of the illegal alien? Well, we know it's the vote, stupid. Governor Jan Brewer of Arizona said, President Obama, broken borders are not a laughing matter. No one in Arizona is laughing. Do your job and secure the border. And what did Obama say? He went to Mexico and he gave an astonishing speech. He said, in the 21st century, we are defined not by our borders, but by our bonds. Effectively, he erased the borders with Mexico with one sentence. Did you hear that? He erased the borders with Mexico with one sentence. Entering the United States illegally has been a crime since 1929. And federal law affirms that it is a crime to be in this country illegally. Did you know that? Now, let's put aside the fact that Napolitano was completely incompetent and should be fired. Because in this case, she is just reflecting the agenda of her boss, President Obama, who wishes to erase the border with Mexico. That is not hyperbole. That's what Obama said to Mexican President Calderon during a MexiFest in the White House. And he said that. In the 21st century, we're defined not by our borders, but by our bonds. Well, I don't agree with him. I believe that he is erasing our national identity. I believe that when you see members of La Raza and Micha, the subversive base of a Chicano leftist takeover, are deeply embedded in this administration, you should be very worried indeed. When you see that criminal aliens, who account for more than 29% of all prisoners in Federal Bureau of Prison facilities, are draining us dry, and that the percentage of all federal prison inmates is even higher, you don't understand this. Investors Business Daily reported in 2005 that about half the prisoners in that state of California were illegals, 50%, adding to the financial burden the average American is supposed to pay. That's the single biggest problem in California, and the phony Whitman didn't even bring it up. She's not going to do much different than Schwarzenegger has done. So look into this issue of the real cost of legalizing illegals. Sure, it's the vote, stupid. Hey, Savage Nation. This is Michael with an urgent message about the economy. Listen, there's been a lot of talk about the dangers of inflation, of deflation, of a double-dip recession, even the possibility of a depression. We now have mainstream economists warning that our whole economy, our liberty, on the brink of collapse. I think most people are completely confused by it all, but I've discovered a report that helped me understand what's about to happen. It's entitled Spiraling into a Greater Depression. I want you to get your free copy now. How? By calling 1-800-800-8255. 1-800-289-2646, 1-800-289-2646, or online at libertyisgolden.com. Visit libertyisgolden.com. I repeat, the answers to this crisis are all covered in this free report, spiraling into a greater depression. And as a bonus, I'm going to include a free pocket constitution, which I think every American should reread before the November election. Call now, 800-289-2646, 1-800-289-2646, or visit libertyisgolden.com. Libertyisgolden.com. It's a message from me to you. Get it.
Call Michael now at 1-800-449-8255.
Savage.
Savage. George Bush promises not to attack Obama, and he gave his first speech in Canada. In Canada. He wouldn't dare show his face in America. The man who said that we should have deregulation, no regulation, let the free market
determine the best for the people.
Savage.
Now, you know I've criticized that rubbish from the Republicans for years. I was on to this years ago. I called them liars, the Republicans. I called them phonies. I called them gangsters. What more can I do? Say it again? What, am I going to get a halo for this? You don't know already what's true, that both parties are criminals? 99% of both parties are run by gangsters. It may as well be Mexico. We may as well be living in Mexico. What do you have faith in any of this? You think anyone's going to suffer? They're going to take money away from these criminals? They are the same. They give them the money back. It's a cycle.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
The reason the rich support Obama is because they think that they can control him and bring about a shrinking of the middle class and a new Soviet America where there will be the ruling class and the peasants, of which they will be the ruling class, and he will be continue to be their friend, colleague, and puppet. What they don't understand is that Obama's smarter than they are. Much like a certain Austrian was originally used by the Krupp Steel Corporation and other large manufacturers in Germany who thought that they could manipulate this charismatic young man who was running around Germany raising so much interest in politics. And they thought that they could put him in power, this young man from Austria, and eventually manipulate him. Little did they know that he was using them. They weren't using him. I have studied Hitler's rise from the time he was a mere corporal in World War I, and somewhat of a war hero, by the way, and how when the National Socialists first emerged on the scene in Germany, which, remember, was a democracy during the Weimar Republic, how he was in bed with all the industrialists. The rich of the country loved him. The rich liked what they were hearing. The rich loved it. You didn't know that Hitler was a back-to-nature man, did you? Many of you don't even know. You're so ignorant of history, I can't blame you. I blame the education system. He was a vegetarian. He didn't drink. He was a back-to-nature movement guy. But more than that, he was anti-capitalist, so they thought. The socialists who were aligned with Hitler, the National Socialists, were against private property and ownership. But Hitler didn't go for that right away. As a matter of fact, it led to a big fight within the Nazi Party itself. Soon after Hitler aggrandized a great deal of power to himself and established his dictatorship, his original thugs, his supporters, the brown shirts, and the Ernst Röhm, the street fighter, and he had a big fight because Ernst Röhm was a diehard socialist, and they fought. And he said to Hitler, how could you be doing business with all these capitalists when we are supposed to be such pure socialists? But Hitler was far smarter than Ernst Röhm. He knew that he continued to need the big capitalists to advance the Nazi agenda. And so he never outright attacked the big capitalists. He worked with them. So Ernst Röhm and the other diehard socialists in the SA, the brown shirts, rebelled. As a result, they were exterminated in the Night of the Long Knives, which you should study one day. When Hitler's SS lay in wait for the SA, who were in a male bacchanalia on a certain lake in Germany with each other. The SA, as you see, were oriented in that direction. Study it. It's historical. The SA leadership were having fun with their boyfriends on a certain lake in Bavaria. The SS lay in wait for them, killed most of them, arrested some of the others, including Ernst Strom, who was later executed. It's a fact of history. It's a fact of history. I'm not embroidering. I'm not inventing. I'm giving you a fact of history. What does it have to do with Obama? Everything and nothing. Everything, because it's quite telling to study how Hitler rose to power using, although he said he was a socialist, he used the capitalist to get to power, okay? And his socialist buddies were very mad at him because he didn't impose his socialism fast enough, so he had them killed. But then, of course, after he had total power, there was another story, which we're not going to have to give you a whole history lesson right now. And I don't really cover this in my book. I touch on it, but it's irrelevant. What's relevant to this discussion is Obama's Marxist socialist roots and why I define him as not a socialist. That's baby talk. You've heard the word, hey, Obama's a socialist. It doesn't mean anything anymore. When I was talking about socialism radio 10 years ago, nobody had used the word in talk radio that I know of. Nobody had used it. They didn't even know what the word meant. Then all of a sudden, they were all, oh, socialist. Well, there are quite a number of varieties of socialist. You have to define what you're talking about. This nation has been somewhat socialist since the 1960s, okay? So what variety of it? How virulent is this socialism? I define Obama as a pan-Leninist. That's something you haven't heard about. The golfer doesn't know what the word means. If you say pan-Leninist to the golfer, he'd have to look it up because he hasn't seen it anywhere. If you said it to a wall banger, he would get embarrassed and angry and fire somebody. If you said it to the leprechaun, he propped the phrase pan-Leninist to understand it. And then you'll understand Obama when he says, we didn't do this just to elect a man. So I want you to play that whole soundbite now, and you'll understand what I mean when I say pan-Leninist if you listen to that soundbite again.
If you are out there knocking on doors and making phone calls, talking to your friends and neighbors, if you do not give up hope, then I guarantee you that not only are we going to win this election, because this was never just about putting a president in the White House, it was about building a movement for change that lasted for a long time. We will build
building a movement for change that lasts a long time. Now, does that definitively prove he's a pan-Leninist? Of course not. But he certainly gives away an intimation of what I am talking about. And the rest you have to, study to get to the bottom of it. So when you look at the adulation of one-third of the population that gave Hitler the power in Germany, and you hear what I just said? The adulation of one-third of the population that brought Hitler to power. And you look at the adulation of the one-third of the American population that brought Obama to power. You say, well, all right, that doesn't prove anything either, does it? You got to understand that most Germans did not even go along with the crude imagery of the early Nazi party. They didn't even like the anti-Semitism of the early Nazi movement at all. Most Germans were quite polite. They did not go along with the crude images that Hitler was putting out there. Nor were they likely to become involved in or approve of physical violence directed at individual Jews and their property. Did you understand any of this? It was a very small fringe in the Nazi movement that was anti-Semitic to this degree. Many of you don't understand how the leftist thinks of the radical university Lexist. Most of them are maniacs. You think you hear electric cars, you hear Obamacare. These are just minor details to them. They would like to have a complete and total socialist revolution in America, where masses of people were taken out, put into re-education camps along the lines of the Red Brigades in Cambodia or the Red Communist Chinese in China. This is very serious business that we're talking about. You got to understand this. The misery that is felt by society today is directly related to the pacifism that is rampant in our military today. The internationalism that is rampant in our political class today, and the rot that is set in Washington. You understand what I'm saying to you? I don't have to go into a tirade right now to make my point. I don't have to do that at all. We know that the decayed old political system in America is cracking right now. We know that we have to build a new America built on the fundamental values that built America. We know we have to build America based on the basis of achievement, strength, will, struggle, freeing the genius of the individual personality. But you don't hear any of this rhetoric coming from any of the politicians, do you? You hear it in crude form, but not really in the way I just put it to you. How can the strength of the nation be improved is the question. Do you think Obama can rescue the common strength of the nation? I don't. I think that he has ruined the nation in the 2 years he's been in power. And I believe the only thing that can save America will be to select the best Americans irrespective of their race or their sex or their sexual orientation based on their achievement, their strength, their will, their ability to struggle, their ability to work, so we can free the genius of the individual personality. That's what we need in America.
Savage.
Let's go to the callers. Ron in Houston. As I said, I get distracted easily. Ron, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hello, Michael. I had an interesting experience today in Humble, Texas, the famous oil town here in Texas. And I finally got them to admit that the book exists. And they just called me up today after 3 days and said it's there. But my son and I were talking this morning. He's just joined the French Foreign Legion. And I was telling him what's in
your book. Wow, he must be some tough customer. I didn't even know that he's an American citizen who joined the French Foreign Legion?
Yeah, well, if you knew his mother, my former wife, you know why he left his country and had to get away from her.
Hey, thanks for getting that one in.
Yeah, well, what happens is that he cannot believe these engagement rules. He told me today, and he's listening on the internet right now. It's 11:30 out there, and he said he was going to go to his girlfriend's house tonight, and he's going to he should be listening right now, so he should hear me. But the point is that he says that they are taught to shoot through the women to get the enemy. And if anybody's walking away who they think is involved in the battle, shoot them in the back.
Unbelievable. Well, that's why we're still in Iraq and still in Afghanistan. It's because the rules of engagement were written by a bunch of idiots who have made certain that the wars never end in order to make certain that the American taxpayer is built for as many trillions as possible in contracting dollars. There's no other reason for them. No other reason but to keep the war going for the war machine.
Right, but he's been training the last 2 weeks in street fighting. And they were in a mock-up of Afghanistan, and
yeah.
He says that the bottom line is that they're being trained somewhat like the Navy SEALs. This is what they've been told by their commanders, and he told his commanders about your book, and they want to see it. So I'm going to send him one as soon as I get my hands on it. And, so he can read it to his commanders. They don't believe what's going on.
Well, nobody can believe the rules of engagement that are uncovered and exposed in my book. And by the way, I know this is, Woodward's book has beaten mine last week. That book has nothing in it that anyone needs to read. Let me go right head on head with these two other books. My book is the only book that really exposes anything about the Obama administration that is worth knowing. The rest is nothing but media hype. And you need to get the book, and I'm sending you three copies, one for you and two for the men over there. By the way, before you go, how is it that an American can join the French Foreign Legion? Is that allowed, I guess?
He's got two passports, American and English. He was born in France, but any American can join. Because
Wait, so that means your ex-wife was French?
Yeah.
You should have said that when you said your ex-wife. You should have said my ex-French wife, his French mother. That would have said everything.
I'm sending her a copy of Liberalism is a Mental Disorder. I found it.
Well, wait a minute. I have a sequel coming out, which is Gold Diggers Anonymous.
But guess what? The guy in a bookstore, this is a used bookstore, that had your books in it, too. He's got a green beard. And I was in there, and I pointed out, I said, look at that. Just like Michael Savage says, you got a green beard. And then I look at the girl behind the counter. I said, look at that. You got green eyes. I said, Michael Savage predicted you'd be here today.
Hey, is a green beard normal in Texas at this time of year?
I neglected to ask him why, but, you know, it's got something to do with the greenies.
Well, I guess it's got something to do with the time of year in Texas and the amount of toe juice that they're drinking. No, I understand it. I understand that toxic toe juice in small portions produces a certain kind of psychedelic high and it turns your beard green. I don't know.
Could be. I don't know. But, you know, think about it.
Well, look, good luck with your son, and send us a body count of how many he kills over there.
You know,
I got to tell you a funny story. War is about killing the enemy, you know. It's not about serving them hot and ready meals. You know that.
Yeah.
And the day you start teaching our men to worry more about the enemy's rights and the enemy's state of mind, that we're finished as a nation. I got to tell you something. No, I got to tell you something. Every ex-combat soldier that I've run into tells me the same story over and over again, that all of them were sent over there to act as cannon fodder for one administration after another. None of them was sent over there to kill. And when they do their job, they're held up on charges.
Yeah, well, they got a saying in French. Translated in English, it goes like this. Teach them a lesson they remember for as long as they live. Kill them.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, I took a young man in who was a former combat veteran into a restaurant, a friend of mine, a couple of months ago, owned by an Italian man. And the minute I introduced him, I said, this is my friend and just came back from Iraq recently. And the minute this Italian man met him, he said, how many did you kill? He said it with joy. I mean, isn't that what he went over there for? He didn't go over there to serve him hot and ready a falafel, did he?
Oh, he's ready. I tell you, it's unbelievable. His training is you know, really intense stuff. Out of a class of something like 50 people, there were only 7 or 8 that made it through and got accepted into the French Foreign Legion.
How'd your son turn out so tough with the French mother?
Because of her.
What do you mean? You mean he had to learn how to be tough to live with her? Is that it?
Well, if you knew her, okay, you'd believe in that basically you'd be a combatant, okay? Because at three different times I had to pull a knife out of my body with her, okay?
Oh, wait, this is getting interesting. You mean she became physical to that level?
Oh, yeah, she stabbed me once in Paris. She stabbed me once when we used to live in Florida. And there were numerous threats. And on one occasion, she tried to drown my son in 1999. And I happened on the scene and saved his life. And she held his head underwater for well over a minute. And then when she saw me, she released him. And he come up and he said, Mommy tried to drown me. Mommy tried to drown me. And she
No, she was just training him for the French Foreign Legion. She was giving him early training.
Yeah, you know, she do. I'm trying to teach him a lesson.
Oh, she was teaching him how to survive waterboarding.
Yeah, she's psychotic, is what she is.
No, she sounds like she belongs in a mental hospital, or at least working for the Obama administration, one or the other.
Well, she's an airline, so she thinks she's wonderful.
Oh, she's an airline flight attendant. What if you say the wrong thing to her on the plane? I can just imagine that one.
Oh, she's got a lot of people to lose their jobs already. She's written people up and knocked them off and lost their careers. She's a real wonder.
Was she good looking to go with it? Is that how you got seduced?
Oh, absolutely gorgeous. And one of the most beautiful women I've ever seen in my life. And this girl would knock you out. She walked away. She was offered a job by a friend of mine in Hollywood to do Elizabeth Taylor look-alike movie, okay? And she walked away from it. That's how beautiful this girl is.
And how did you meet her?
Paris Air Show, 1999, rather.
Are you a former pilot, Ron?
Yeah, sure am. Yep.
Are you a former Marine pilot or U.S. Air Force or what?
Strictly civilian and commercial aviation.
But you were at an air show. You run into her. She was there. What? Just trying to meet rich guys who were buying planes?
No, she was working there and just intermingled and happened to meet her and brought her to America, took her to Broadway, showed her how American life is like, you know, took her to Phantom of the Opera, you know, and showed her, to, you know, the Lincoln Arts Center. She's very
So she swept you off your feet right off the bat.
Yeah, essentially she sure did. I mean, it's, you know, a chick like this will blow a man away. She had everything going. She could.
But I mean, truthfully, let's be clear. We're both adults. There's not, did you sleep with her the first night?
Hell no. No, I played it really American-like, you know, Puritan American, more or less, you know. Yeah, she appreciated that.
Oh, so you're both, it's almost like Prezi's Honor. You were both playing each other. No, you know what I'm saying? You are both like a spy, counter spy. You were playing the American gentleman when you really aren't. And she was playing the lady by, and by what you're telling me, maybe she really isn't.
No, but you know, the problem is that her psychosis began to develop later on, and I found out a lot about her childhood. And of course, she was abused physically by her father, brutal French, you know, and beat over the head with brooms and sticks.
Now I'm starting to think you're embroidering. You're calling me from a madhouse in Houston. Now you're making this up. Wow,
really?
My God. So before you go, because you got my curiosity and everyone else listening, how long did you live with this hellion?
Well, we had a pretty good marriage for about 9 years, and when it fell apart, man, it fell apart in such a way. And her, to this day, she's got somebody she's married to who was her boyfriend before, who occasionally threatens to kill me and things like that. And basically, that's one of the other reasons that Berenger, it's a thing.
So that's why you sent your son to the French Foreign Legion so he can come back and act as your bodyguard.
Well, I may need it.
All right, you're a good sport. This has been good as Groucho Marx. What I'd like to do is send you 3 copies of Trickle Up Poverty, one for you, one for your son, and one for the commanding officer of the French Foreign Legion.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
The big story to me is that Nancy Pelosi is the most abusive congressional individual in the history of the Congress. She and her family and staff took 85 tax-paid trips on military airplanes between March of 2009 and June 2010. This is according to new documents uncovered by Judicial Watch. Pelosi's daughter and son-in-law, who, by the way, is the son of the filmmaker who will remain unnamed, and 2 grandsons were on the June 20th, 2009 flight from Andrews Air Force Base to San Fran, where Pelosi lives. So they're using it as a taxi service. On July 2nd, 2010, Nancy Pelosi took a grandson on a flight from Andrews Air Force Base to Travis Air Force Base, north of San Francisco. The documents reveal that Pelosi's travel has cost the United States Air Force $2.1 million over a 2-year period, $101,000 of which was for in-flight expenses, including food and alcohol. For example, purchases for one Pelosi-led congressional delegation included Johnny Walker Red, Grey Goose Vodka, E&J Brandy, Bailey's Irish Cream, Maker's Mark Whiskey, Courvoisier Cognac, Bacardi Light Rum, Jim Beam Whiskey, Beefeater Gin, Dewar's Scotch, Bombay Sapphire Gin, Jack Daniel's Whiskey, Corona Beer, and several bottles of wine. And you say, well, what's the big deal? Well, if you don't know that that's a big deal, then you really shouldn't be listening to this show. You really shouldn't be listening to the show. You should have no concept of voting, even. You should lose the right to vote. We have never had a more corrupt, arrogant regime in the history of the United States of America. Never. Never, never. If we had a truly independent FBI, these trips by Pelosi would have been investigated when they were first reported. Bonnie Frank's flights on a jet owned by a hedge fund billionaire who received $200 million in bailout money would have been investigated, et cetera, and so on. So what can I tell you? 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. Pelosi and family flights, 85 trips on military aircraft. And then wait. The commander-in-chief gives a speech to a group of dumb students, and he is talking about, a questioner says to him, there's an increase in racial tension in America, and why is there an increase in racial tension? Obama comes back and says, a tribal attitude is causing it. So the college teacher says, historically, when you look at how America has evolved, typically we make progress on race relations in fits and starts. He then said that the recession has played a part in driving racial antagonism while he has been in office. And he said, it's all a result of tribalism. Tribalism. Well, I would argue that it's a result of him because he has purposely driven a wedge between the races. Obama is the most divisive president in American history. He has played class warfare from the day he has taken office. When I got news for you, people are not that stupid. I want to show you something. And it's not offensive at all, by the way. I look at some of the comments on some of these, you know, like these appear on CBS, NBC, whatever. If you read what people are writing, they're pretty clever. And some of them really take umbrage at what this man says. And here's what someone wrote. He said, we're instructed about tribalism from this person. He takes teachable moments to instruct us about everything that is wrong with America. His wife electioneers inside a polling place. And it says they are the quintessential phonies. VH Obama lectures us from his superior cultural position. His biological father was a communist, anti-colonialist, and a reprobate. His grandparents were anti-American communists. Almost all American communists I have known, he writes, and there are several, always quick to blame, first the rich, then a family member, then someone else, then whoever, for their own personal failings. They always felt shortchanged and deprived and entitled. Mean, sour, mendacious people, always looking to trip someone in the dark, to trick and deceive. Barack and Michelle Obama, to trick and deceive. I find that fascinating. When Obama says a tribal attitude surfaces in tough times, and that's why there's racial division in America. No, he and Michelle have caused the racial division. By the way, play Barack Obama's tribal attitude clip. Go ahead, please.
You know, if everybody's working and feeling good and making money and buying a new house and a big screen TV, you're less worried about what other folks are doing. And when you're out of work and you can't buy a home or you've lost your home, and you're worried about paying your bills, then you become more worried about what other folks are doing. And sometimes that organizes itself around kind of a tribal attitude, and issues of race become more prominent.
He's trying to justify his having flared up racial enmity in America, blaming it on the economy, but in fact, it's not solely about the economy. It's really about him using the tool of racism to exploit racism, to provoke racism, in my humble opinion. Play clip 22.
The truth is that this is the hard part. But remember, that's exactly what Barack told us. You remember? He told us that what change is hard. He said change is slow. Said it doesn't just happen on its own. Shoot, from the first days as a nation, every time folks have tried to make change, they have faced fear and doubt. They face setbacks and disappointments. But remember, as Americans, we have always pushed past the cynicism, kept moving forward.
Right.
And that's exactly what we have to do
right
today.
Right on.
Wisconsin, that
bring
is
it
exactly
all down, girl.
What we have to do today, because there is so much at stake right now.
That's right. Unless you can push your pan-Leninist agenda down our throats before you're out of office, that's correct. See, many of you are under the delusion, or illusion, shall I say, that come a November, which is scarcely 2.5 weeks away, when the Democrats finally get the whipping that they deserve, you think all will be well. But there's a couple of problems. Number one, you're going to get a lot of the K Street crowd back in the Republican Party who are just as corrupt as the Democrats. That's number one. And number two, you don't understand the Obamas if you think that he's going to learn by America's discontent. He is only going to dig his heels in further. He and Michelle are on a mission. They are revolutionaries. They are not normal first lady and first man type of thing. They are revolutionaries, and they want to transform America into a communist slash Marxist, or shall I say, into a pan-Leninist entity, not even a state. They don't even see this as a nation. They see America as an entity that they were sent here to alter and tear apart and break down and change into something that is so beyond comprehension, you don't even see it happening. She's right that change is slow and hard and doesn't happen on its own. Every time someone tried to make change, they faced fear and doubt. How about when they faced opposition from those who didn't want to turn it into a fascist dictatorship run by a group of socialist goons? You want to call us names because we don't like your nationalizations? We know that the puppet masters put the two of you in power. We know that. We know who you are affiliated with. I spell it out in The Nightmare on Wall Street in Trickle Up Poverty. And if you disagree with what I'm saying, I challenge you to read that chapter, read the references, and call the show and debate me. And if you can't debate me, then you are wrong. That's all.
Savage.
Love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. Love it.
I'm writers and critics who prophesize with your pen. And keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win. For the times, they are a-changing.
What a great poet he is. The real McCoy. Still out there, still strumming, still singing. Very hard to make a buck at age 70 as a singer. Let me tell you, I admire the guys who are still out on the road. They are keeping up the trucking. I don't know where their money went, but you know, it doesn't stick to your fingers when you're in the music business. They have to perform to make a buck. They don't have a talk show. They can't sit in pajamas watching the Blue Angels while talking about their best-selling book. You have to get up there. You have to sing. I couldn't do it. How does he do it? I don't understand how the guy does it. I really don't. Louder, 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 louder.
Changing.
I got a migraine on me, boy, to be fair. I don't know, it's clamped down. With everything, the right side of my head, it's just...
Mothers and fathers,
well,
throughout the land,
what can I tell you? Stopping Obama's attack on our borders, economy, and security, it says it all. So what do you want to do, read from the book? 11 chapters. I would challenge you to tell me that there's one other book out there on the right where any single chapter of mine is not more detailed than their whole book. I don't know. The Purple Gang won't have me on. I don't need them. They need me. I am repeating this for a reason. Yes, there's a degree of competitiveness in me. I will admit it. But for me to have driven the book to the top of the charts without them indicates that talk radio is still dominant in terms of the world of political ideas in this country. I did it on this show. It was done nowhere else. We kept hearing talk radio is this, talk radio is that. It's only for old people. Talk radio is dead. Cable news is king. Internet is king. I don't say they don't have a powerful influence. You got to be a fool not to say so. At this stage, though, you'd have to admit, no matter how much of a doubting Thomas you are, that Michael Savage has rescued talk radio from the gallows. If anyone out there has been doubting whether talk radio still is powerful, let me tell you something. It is more powerful today than it ever has been in my 16-year career. Much more powerful today. More listeners than ever. More influence than ever. That's if you're in the inner ring. If you're in the inner ring, you have an audience that needs you and listens to you. And if you make sense, well, you're gonna make a lot of friends. And a lot of unhappy people, too. I wouldn't use the word enemies because we don't yet live in North Korea. When I'm on this radio show, I kind of, it's a no-holds-barred. I speak exactly my mind. I don't know, it's almost a product in a certain way of foolishness, to be frank with you. I got to tell you that. Because I speak with you somehow too honestly. I tell you what I actually think. You know it's gotten me in trouble. I've made some real bad enemies. Mainly the wonderful Brits who banned me from entering their country, linking me up with murderers and terrorists with no help from the ACLU or any of the other so-called First Amendment types here in America. No help whatsoever. But why is it that when I'm on the radio, I speak to you as though no one hears us, as though it's a private conversation? I speak to you as though I'm on the telephone with you, and so I tell you how I see it. Then get in the car, put on the suit, put on the tie, go on TV. Lights on, action on, all of a sudden, I realize that I really shouldn't say everything that I say on the radio on television. It seems to be a different medium. It doesn't permit you to become as intimately truthful as the radio. And I really realized that today for the first time. Some of the things that are in my book that the host read back to me almost sounded shocking to me. Would you believe it? It didn't mean that they didn't make sense or I didn't write it because I believed it. It almost seems shocking. Chapter 10, Obama's War on the Military and on National Security. I mean, it's pretty amazing stuff in this book. And I got to tell you, it's not going to make an awful lot of powerful people happy. So let me begin with A Revolution is Brewing in Chapter 1 because it's filled with personal stories. Actually, you know what? I really want to go to the Wall Street chapter because I want to tell you about my bank account when I was a kid, if I could find that. It's almost one of my favorite stories that you never heard. I don't want to talk about healthcare here. Nightmare on Wall Street. It's a cute story. Here it goes. Can I start with this? Chapter 4, page 79. When I was 11 years old, I had my first bank account at Bankers Trust Company on Union Turnpike in Queens, New York. Each week, I would deposit the money I earned from the local candy store, where I worked after school as a soda jerk. I felt like the richest kid on the planet when the account grew to something like $618.08 after 1 year. One night, while reviewing my account, I discovered something startling. I looked at the balance and discovered that while I had only deposited $600, there was $18 more than I'd actually put in. I went to my father and, holding my savings summary for him to see, I said, "Hey, Dad, the bank made a mistake. They deposited more money than I put in. Should I return it to them?" He said, "Michael, that's your interest." I said, "Dad, what's interest?" He said, "Well, they take your money and they invest it, and then they give you back a little bit of what they make on their investment. That's called interest, and you get to keep it." That was the day I became a capitalist. That's the day when I first understood the value of saving and investing. Over the years, I grew in my understanding of building wealth through savings and investments, as well as the risks and rewards associated with placing funds in the stock market. I imagine you may have had a similar experience when you were young. And if you, like many in the middle class, you probably opened an individual retirement account or employer-based 401k retirement savings plan, maybe in addition to modest investments in the stock market. While you and I played by the rules and trusted Wall Street with our monies, others behind the scenes manipulated America's leading financial institutions for their own personal gain. That gain wasn't just measured in lining their pockets. In some instances, as you'll see in a moment, it was to advance an agenda. Case in point, page 80. In 2007, Christopher Cox, then chairman of the SEC, under pressure from lobbyists, did not prevent the change of two regulations that allowed hedge fund pirates, to plunder the U.S. financial markets. This change in policy was responsible for driving down the value of America's assets by more than $10 trillion in 2008. Let's be clear. There was an agenda lurking behind the shadowy dealings. Is it a coincidence that this happened right before the presidential election? Hardly. Where did those dollars go?
And you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. Or the times they are a-changing.
All right, I'll be right back.
I'm Riders and
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Nightmare on Wall Street. I told you about my first bank account, Bankers Trust. I can still remember the book to this day, right? And I earned interest, and I became a capitalist. Then I told you about Christopher Cox, then chairman of the SEC, under pressure from lobbyists, did not prevent the change of two regulations that allowed hedge fund pirates to plunder the U.S. financial markets. And I said, where did $10 trillion go in 2008? Here we go. Page 80, trickle-up poverty. They ended up in the hands of a relatively small number of people and companies whose purpose was far more nefarious than merely making profits. The raiders who trashed our markets sought nothing less than to use the control they had gained over our financial system to put a wet-behind-the-ears leftist president in office. Moreover, they leveraged that power to create a government-run on socialist principles, but controlled by a small group of wealthy investors who dictate policy to the puppet president they elected. In effect, they pushed us further along the path to a socialist oligarchy. Another player in the financial meltdown is the leftist financier George Soros, who some believe has been trying for decades to manipulate American politics to the advantage of the Marxists with whom he is in league. It seems to me that Soros tried to rig the 2004 presidential election in favor of John Kerry. How? By pouring tens of millions of dollars into Kerry's campaign coffers and into building anti-capitalist, anti-democratic organizations such as MoveOn.org. In spite of that massive investment, Soros was unsuccessful. Did he give up? Far from it, page 81. During the next few years, the Managed Funds Association, MFA, a group of hedge fund investors with whom Soros is affiliated, lobbied SEC Chairman Cox to have the rules changed. Why? So they could engineer a raid on U.S. markets to trigger a financial crisis that they foresaw could turn the election in favor of their 08 candidate, Barack Hussein Obama. This time the strategy worked. In the end, some believe that George Soros and similarly minded financiers benefited in an extraordinary way while moving the country dangerously toward control by leftists. Despite this alleged manipulation of the marketplace, Soros is free and active today. While he's still denying his involvement in one of the greatest scandals in American history, that is when he's not crowing that he had a very good crisis, I'm wondering why there isn't an investigation into this matter. Hundreds upon hundreds of minor players were involved in this fraud as well. Another member of the MFA is John Paulson, no relation to former Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, one of the architects of the TARP bailout. Paulson saw the value of his hedge fund firm rise exponentially in 07, thanks to the rule changes that the MFA lobbied for. While he predicted the crash and the demise of Lehman Brothers and Wachovia, the real reasons he was able to realize huge profits from the financial meltdown were the rule changes that he took advantage of to line his pockets. Paulson, like Cox and Soros, is still plying his trade, in his case as a hedge fund trader. He's still enjoying the billions of dollars in profits he made personally from participating in the attack on the American economy, reference number 4. Now, I got to say something right here. Every one of these statements is backed up with a reference. It's not going to make a lot of people happy. A lot of them are going to deny everything in this book. First, they're going to ignore it. Then they're going to deny it. And then they're going to attack it as sure as I'm sitting here. The fact is the American people deserve an answer. Where did the $10 trillion go that disappeared in 2008? Make no mistake about it. Some people profited tremendously. And I think that you deserve an answer. So there it is. There's a lot more, by the way. You say the two rules. What are the two rules? What do we need to stop these gangsters from operating on Wall Street? When I say these gangsters, I mean the people who are still getting away with murder. The fact of the matter is I spell it out. It's called the Uptick Rule and the Glass-Steagall Act. Remember, there was a depression in 1929. Remember the stock market crash? It was very similar to what we're living through right now. At that time, I remember in high school, I had very smart teachers in Jamaica High School in New York. They taught me that there was a depression. They taught us why it happened. It was plain and simple because it was called speculation. People were allowed to buy stocks on margin. I didn't know what that meant, but my teacher explained it to me. They could buy a stock in a company for nothing down. Nothing down. Why? Mr. and Mrs. America bought lots of stocks for nothing down, and they thought they were getting rich. Or let's say for a few dollars down. It couldn't be nothing down, a few dollars down, because you had to get some of the suckers into the Ponzi scheme. Well, that was one of the things that was changed after the Great Depression. You had to have a minimal amount of money to put in to buy a stock. Same with houses, I've told you before. When I went to buy my first house in 1974, the bank said you had to have 20% down. I said, I have only 15%. They said, come back when you have 20. Now take a look at what went on here. They were selling houses to people and giving them money to take that house. They were giving them a minus 10% mortgage. Many illegal aliens benefited from this. Many people who were not qualified benefited from it. So isn't it inevitable that there would have been a housing crash? It was created. Now let me go to the callers. Las Vegas calls. Christine, you're up on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Dr. Savage. I've had two experiences with trickle-up poverty, and I've only owned the book for 4 hours. The first experience... The first experience was around 12:30 in Las Vegas time. And I went in there looking for your book, and I always look in the front because the new book should be up front. So I looked and looked, and it was nowhere to be found. So I asked a lonely little clerk, and she pointed me into the back by the bargain books in the middle of the store. She says, there it is.
Oh, my God.
I proceeded to ask her, well, why is it here, not up front? And she says, well, this is where the manager wanted it to be.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, here's what I want to know. Christine, where in Las Vegas? Because I am going to tell you right now, I've asked my publisher, if any manager, any clerk does this to the book, they're going to get fired.
It was...
They will get fired. They will get fired. They're violating company policy. They don't run that bookstore. They work for the ownership of the bookstore, and it's a business. It's not a hobby. Now, tell me the good experience.
Well, I'm not done yet.
No.
I went to the front of the store, and I saw an empty rack up front, right up front, in front of the front doors. And so I proceeded to pick up the 12 copies of your book, Trickle Up Poverty, and I proceeded and I put them up front. The manager was going to come over to me, and I could see that, you know, I was in trouble because I moved the book. And
oh.
So I just grabbed my copy and went in line to buy. And as I went into line, I looked for the people that were coming in. It's quite a busy store. Three people came in and asked for your book, and the manager said, well, right here it is, my dear. So as I was going out the store, after I bought the book, the manager told the little lonely clerk that I dealt with the first time to go get the extra copies in the back and to bring them up front.
Oh, my God.
Okay.
So she got frightened that you were an activist and she might get reported and lose her job.
Yeah,
see, you know, wait a minute. You know, there's a moral to this story, Christine. What you just did was brave, number one, and I want to thank you, number two. But in essence, what you did in that bookstore is what's going on at tea parties across America, at town hall meetings. The people are taking charge of their destiny. That's amazing. Are you a member of a local activist group of any kind, Christine?
No, I'm not. But I am a conservative. I am a fifth-generation American. And my great-grandfathers, both of them, fought in the Civil War, and I'm not going to let this country go down without a fight.
And well, you just fought for me. I don't know how to thank you other than to do this, Christine. If you stay on the line, I'm going to send you a free copy, even though you bought one, so you can give it away to a loved one. How's that? Would that work for you? Or give it to a soldier.
Okay.
You know what I want people to do? Buy an extra copy and give it to a man in uniform that you see passing in the street or on an airplane or wherever you are. Would you do that? Would you stay on the line, Christine, because you're going to get it? I'd love to see that. I'd like to see the military get copies of this book for free. I really would. Maybe we can work that out.
Savage.
Let me begin right here with a story. From the book. Every chapter begins with a homey true story. When I was 14, for example, I took a job in a drugstore in Queens, New York. It had nothing in common with the big name brand drugstores found in just about every neighborhood today. This was a simple mom and pop affair. I'll never forget the first time I met Doc the pharmacist. Doc was an Italian immigrant from the old country who probably lived in a small apartment over the pharmacy. Thick set man, oversized shoe on his right foot. The heel must have been 8 inches high to compensate for his short leg. Unlike the sterile-looking pharmacies of today with their harsh overhead lighting designed to give you a migraine so you buy more pain medication, I don't think there was a fluorescent light bulb in the place. You see, Doc's store had wooden shelves sagging under the weight of tonics and lotions and glass display cases with rows of first aid supplies and sundries. These were the old-time pharmacies. It even smelled differently. To this day, I still remember the distinctively pleasant aroma that greeted me the moment I'd walked through the doors of Doc's drugstore. I'll put it to you this way. It was as if the mahogany counters and floor had been scrubbed down with Old Spice and Lysol with a hint of leather. Whatever happened to that incredible smell? I should have bottled it. These days, drugstores smell like, well, I don't know, anything, and nobody knows your name. But with Doc, the pharmacist, you felt like family. Now, let's set aside the fact that he was paying me 50 cents an hour below minimum wage to save a few bucks for himself. To me, I was happy. I had a paying job on the weekends and after school. I was glad for the work and looked forward to going there. I want to ask you something. Are you ready for the battle coming up? Are you ready for the battle? I want to hear you scream yes. Are you ready to go out as an army of savages and savagettes? I want to hear you scream yes. Are you ready to go out there and demand your place in the sun? Are you ready to vote? Are you ready to tell people what's going on? Then you're my people to save the country. It comes down to the wire. Either you throw the Democrats out, you replace them with any Republican. Let me continue about docs. Anyway, I'm there. I'm underaged. I'm getting paid 50 cents an hour under minimum wage after school, and I'm glad for the job. He made me into a pharmacist, in other words, while he ate his meal. Doc's wife, you see, treated him like a king. She'd bring in a big tray with a top to keep the veal parmesan or the homemade feasts warm. So he'd sit at his desk for the better part of an hour, savoring every bite. Preferring to eat his meal in peace, he'd make Michael, the little Michael, the pharmacist. I mean, how hard was it to fill out the prescriptions? All I had to do was read penicillin, 250 milligram, find the right jar that said penicillin, and then count out a dozen pills. I didn't need medical training to count the 12. He taught it to me in 12 minutes. He said, read the prescription. It says penicillin, 250 milligram. He said, make sure it doesn't say 500 or 750. And it says a dozen. You put it in the jar. That's all. 5 minutes. Said 12 minutes, I learned how to be a pharmacist. Now, the only time things got a bit dicey was on the rare occasion when some doctor wanted a blend of drugs ground together. You know, they still did that in those days. He'd ask for 2 milligrams of sulfur powder and a half a gram of phosphorus plus other ingredients. Now, these doc would compound himself. All I did was count pills like today's college-educated pharmacists. So, one afternoon, I'm doing my job, counting out pills, minding my own business, while Doc was wiping the sauce from the edges of his mouth. In walks a guy in a dark suit and a receding hairline. He looked a lot like Robert Duvall as Tom Hagen in The Godfather. I glanced up as he approached the counter. I never saw the man before, and I had no idea what he wanted. So he studies me like a hawk through the glass, and he's watching me filling out the prescriptions. And then, with a fake smile, he says, "Hi, how are you, son?" "Fine," I said. Well, I didn't know at the time why he was scoping out the place. Something about him made me instinctively wary. So I said, "Can I help you, mister?" "No, no, just looking," he said. He raised an eyebrow like an IRS agent who just found an unreported nickel during an audit. His eyes darting around the drugstore zeroed in on Doc sitting beside me eating the last few bites of his veal parmesan. The next minute he marches behind the counter to Doc, pulls out his ID and says, "I got real bad news for you, Doc." I later learned he was a city government inspector. That afternoon, Doc got hit with a fine and I lost my job. It was a watershed moment in my life. Now, looking back, there have been two life-changing outcomes from those experiences working in the pharmacy. I came away with a profound interest in medicine, and years later went on to write several best-selling books on the topic. That's number one. Second, I grew to be leery of government intervention, particularly when a bureaucrat flashes a fake smile and pretends to be to he or she is there for my benefit. Can you blame me? Back then, I lost my job when the government stepped in. Today, I'm losing the best healthcare system in the world because the government seized this industry and now controls 1/6 of the economy. On March 23, 2010, with the stroke of a pen, our naked emperor signed a death certificate on what was once the greatest healthcare system in history and the envy of the world. Now, by the way, that sentence alone is the best sentence you've ever heard on the healthcare scheme. Our naked emperor signed a death certificate on what was once the greatest healthcare system in history and the envy of the world. He did so even after the overwhelming majority of Americans, a full 61%, opposed it, saying Congress should scrap that plan and start all over again. As the deadline for passage approached, an estimated 100,000 calls an hour from irate voters bombarded Congress. None of that mattered to Barack Obama, Nancy Pelosi, or Harry Reid. In order to usher in socialized medicine, these demon cats shackled the middle class with $2 trillion in new debt, reference 6. Not the $940 billion figure touted by Team Obama. That, according to the CBO, Congressional Budget Office, is the real cost of the bill's first decade. As the Weekly Standard points out, the CBO says we need to start the clock when the cost would actually start in any meaningful way in 2014. In other words, Obamacare is a ticking time bomb. It's set to explode after Obama leaves office, saddling us with skyrocketing debt, reduced care, and unprecedented invasion of privacy. The painful side effects caused by this bill will be lethal to the physical and financial health of Americans. And I go on, I spell it out for you, okay? Here's a new one. My book is called Trickle Up Poverty, right? And I'm focusing on the economy. Now, one of the most corrupt officials in the entire government is the loudest liberal. Don't you always notice that? The loudest liberal is usually the dirtiest of the bunch. The one who screams the most about the poor, and you help the poor, and you help the poor. Listen to this story about Bonnie Frank. Now, I'm not mocking Bonnie Frank because of his lifestyle. I understand that Bonnie Frank has a dog, and it's not a husky, it's a hussy. And I understand that we've gone from huskies to hussies in one generation, and I don't blame him solely for that one. He can have a hussy as a dog just as I could have a poodle. But a story came out in the Boston Herald. If this doesn't prove beyond a reasonable doubt how corrupt this individual is, I'd like to know what would. What will change your psychotic mind to understand how rotten these people are? Here it is. Boston Herald. U.S. Rep. Bonnie Frank, immersed in one of the toughest political fights of his career, took a free private jet to the Virgin Islands courtesy of a Maine congresswoman's billionaire fiancé. Now, unto itself, that doesn't bother me. They all do this jet thing, even though it's illegal what he did, by the way. Okay? Somewhat. Or let's say quasi-legal. And it doesn't look kosher. But wait, it gets worse. The fiancé upon whose jet he flew owned a hedge fund. He still does, by the way. Paloma Securities, a subsidiary of Mr. Sussman's Greenwich, Connecticut-based hedge fund, here it is, received $200 million in 2009 as part of the $180 billion federal bailout of troubled insurance giant AIG record show. Now, if this is not criminal behavior and criminal activity, I'd like to know what is. Can anyone listening to this show who is out of a job or who lost his mortgage tell me that you will ever vote for a Democrat when you see that Bonnie Frank pushed $200 million of federal bailout money to a hedge fund billionaire? You're telling me that's the country you want to live in? And remember, Bonnie Frank voted for the bailout in October of 08. And he reported this trip on the guy's jet in required House financial filings and valued the flight at $1,500. Originally, Bonnie listed the trip vaguely as, quote, first-class round-trip travel by private aircraft in a congressional filing in May. Then in July, Bonnie Frank amended the report to show he traveled from Portland, Maine to the Virgin Islands. And he called the discrepancy a clerical error. Sussman is a huge Democratic campaign donor with homes in Maine and Connecticut, but he is living in St. John, the Virgin Islands. Now, why would a Democrat billionaire who has homes in Maine and Connecticut with a private jet live in St. John, the Virgin Islands? And why would Bonnie Frank steer $200 million of federal bailout money to a hedge fund? Ladies and gentlemen, we are living not in a banana republic, because that may be seen as a salacious statement, given that I am talking about Bonnie Frank. So I cannot say we are living in a banana republic in that regard. We are living in something even lower than a banana republic under these huskies who are now running the United States of America.
Savage.